Romans 1:18 through 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because they may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his external power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened.
The last time I had an opportunity to speak with you, we talked about the first 17 verses of Romans chapter 1. And we noted that Paul introduced there the idea of the gospel to the church in Rome. And Paul pointed out that this gospel is the story that God has been talking about since before the beginning of the world, that this is the subject that God has been occupied with for eternity. We also noted that Paul pointed out to them that at its heart and soul, and most fundamentally and essentially, the gospel is about Jesus of Nazareth. And then Paul said in verses 5 through 15 that that story is the story that God meant to be preached and to be heard, because in it lies the power of God for our salvation. I'd like for us to pick up in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18 this evening, and to continue on with what Paul says to the church in Rome about this gospel. Paul is going to now explain to them in detail this gospel that he has introduced to them in the first 17 verses, that he has kind of laid a sketch of in those introductory thoughts. But before Paul can talk about Jesus Christ, and before he can talk about the power of God unto salvation, we first have to come to establish the fact of sin. Because if there is no sin, there is no need for salvation. There's no need for rescue if we're not guilty of anything that is going to cause us to be condemned or face the wrath of God. Salvation implies that something needs to be delivered from. And that is where Paul begins in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, to talk about the problem and the fact of sin. And that might seem like such a very simple thing to you and I. We wonder sometimes perhaps why it is that Paul takes so much of the book of Romans to talk about the establishment of the fact of sin. Why couldn't Paul have just said that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and moved on with the story of the gospel? Well, the fact is that the fact that all have sinned, is a little bit more complicated than just that plain statement of it might turn out to be. And it's not complicated in the sense that it is an intricate idea, that it is something that requires a lot of concentration and figuring out. No, the reason it is complicated is because of people's attitudes about sin. Because the fact is that nobody wants to admit that they're a sinner. Nobody wants to see themselves as a sinner. And Paul says, therefore, we have to start with the hard part. We've got to understand that sin is the problem of mankind. It's not just some other guy's problem either, that all have sinned. This is the very thing that people don't want to begin with. And so because it is difficult in that sense, because it is the kind of topic that people don't want to hear, Paul therefore takes pains to establish it. And starting in chapter 1 and verse 18, and going down to the end of chapter 1, Paul's theme in those verses is the guilt of the Gentiles. And Paul makes there a famous and important case to establish that the Gentiles are indeed sinners in the sight of God. And Paul says that they have done three things that establish this. The first one is there in verse 18. Paul has just talked about the righteousness of God being revealed for this salvation that is necessary. So why do we need this salvation? Paul says, because, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And here's the first thing Paul says, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The first thing that the Gentiles did is that they suppressed the truth. And the Gentiles might be looking at that and say, now how could we have suppressed the truth? God didn't give us the Ten Commandments. God did not enter into a covenant with us at Mount Sinai. It was with those other people. No, we didn't have a truth to suppress. We were out there on our own, and what we wound up is what we had, and therefore it shouldn't be accounted to us as our fault. And Paul says, oh no, that's not the case. You Gentiles had the truth available to you all along, but you chose to suppress it. Now, how did they know the truth? Paul says in verse 19, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Don't tell me, Paul says, you didn't know about God. I don't want to hear the pagans saying that we had no idea that God was around. Paul says all you had to do is look at the stars and look at the hills and look at the rivers and look at the world that God has created, because all around you, as the psalmist said in Psalm 19, day to day pours forth speech and night unto night utterance. Its voice has gone out to the end of the world. The heavens are declaring the glory of God, that the created order says that there is a God, that from the beginning of the creation, since God made it, it has been a reflection of the God behind it, and that his attributes can be seen by what he left in this world. All you had to do, Paul says, was look at the created world around you, and you could have known that there was a God. And not only could you have known that there was a God, but you could have known two things about this God. First of all, you should have known and could have known and must have known about his eternal power. Because you can't look at this world and at this universe and the sky and the sun and the moon and the stars and all of these things and say that that was put here by some weakling. Oh, it had to be a God of tremendous power to make all that we see around us. And then there's a second thing you should have known about God, Paul says, and that is that he's not a man, that he is of a divine nature, that he is not like the gods that the pagans proclaimed that had human emotions and human attributes and even acted like human beings. Oh, you should have known that this God is no man, that he is far beyond that which is mortal and that which is fleshly. Yes, you should have known that, Paul says. But the fact is that they willfully ignored what they knew. They ignored what was obvious to them. And so Paul says in verse 21 that even though they knew God, now they didn't know him in the closest possible terms, and that's not what Paul's saying. And they surely didn't know the details about what God thought and about God's will and God's plan, but they knew that he was there. They knew that he was a divine being. They knew that he was a powerful being. They knew at least enough to pay attention to him. They knew enough about him to know that he was worthy of their reverence and their fear and their awe. And so even though they knew God, they did not honor him or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened, and professing to be wise, they became fools. They ignored what was obvious. And when they ignored what was obvious, the only thing left for them was to enter into speculation. Well, if I'm not going to acknowledge this God out here who has left his mark on everything that we see, then it's up to me to figure out what I think God is all about. And that is exactly the course that the pagans went through. And I want you to realize what Paul is saying here, because Paul is writing here in the first century AD, back in the classical world. And Paul is saying that You take all the great people that the Greeks produced, Aristotle's and the Plato's and the Heraclitus's and all of those people, considered to be some of the wisest and smartest men, even today we still read their writings. Paul says that they became fools. They didn't know what they were talking about because they had chosen to leave God out of the picture from the very beginning. But that's not the only thing that makes the Gentiles guilty. Secondly, Paul says, they became idolaters. The situation went from bad to worse. So in verse 23, that not only had they chosen to be ignorant of God, even though the knowledge was there for the having, they also exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. And in this sense, they robbed God of the glory that was due to Him. And all of this worship that they went through for hundreds and hundreds of years, and all of this religion that they practiced, it wasn't honoring God. It wasn't there to praise and to thank the God who had left His mark on this world. No, it was to praise and honor something that wasn't God. To praise something and honor something that was in the form of that which is corruptible, something like a bird or an animal. Take that and say, this is what my God is like. And I'm going to thank it, and I'm going to give it the credit, and I'm going to ask it for help. What blasphemy. They took the glory that was due to God and gave it to things that were not worthy of it. And as such, it was an insult. It was a reproach to God. It was a kind of blasphemy. Therefore, Paul says in verse 25 that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. That's the first thing they did. And the second thing is they worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And the third thing they did that establishes their guilt is that they became thoroughly immoral and corrupt. Paul says in verse 26, for this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions. Their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. In the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another. Men with men committing indecent acts, receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness and wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. You look at it and say, goodness gracious, what wicked people they were. And there's still a world full of them today. Because not only do they know that God exists, and not only have they chosen to worship that which they know is not God, they have decided to completely ignore anything and everything that has to do with the true God. And as a result, without God in their lives, they became, and today they still become, the degenerate people that all who reject God eventually must become. And what Paul is talking about here is not some once-in-a-millennium kind of thing. This is not some kind of anomaly in the history of the world. Paul's point is that if you're going to ignore God and if you're not going to follow after God, that this is what your life will become like. It's not going to be any better than this. It can't be any better than this because it is a life that is simply after the indulgence of the flesh. And that's where all of these things come from. Without God in the picture, all you're left with is you and the satisfaction of your own lusts and the gratification of your fleshly desires and all the selfishness and the arrogance and the hatred that goes along with it. And how did these people get this way? By deciding not to acknowledge God. You know, it always pains me when I hear of some brother or sister whom I know in Christ, and somebody says, oh, they've left the faith. And I've known many such people. I've had people even in my own family who have left the faith. And they think when they do it, well, I'm still a good person. And I just don't want to be part of that church anymore, but I'm not going to go off and into the deep end. Well, you might not go off into the deep end tomorrow, and you still might have some goodness in you today, but you live that life long enough, and this is what you will become. And there is no other thing for you to become. This is what life must be like without God in it. But Paul's longer discussion is not about the Gentiles. Because the Jews looked at this and said, that's right, Paul, you tell them. Those Gentiles are sinners. They knew that God was out there and they didn't recognize God, and they lived these horrible, degenerate, immoral lives. And yes, Paul, you tell them. You tell them what's wrong with you. Paul says, now, the other thing I want to establish is the guilt of the Jews. And starting in chapter 2 and verse 1, therefore, you have no excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. And at that point, the Jews began to say, now wait a minute, Paul, that's not us. It's one thing to talk about the Gentiles and their depravity and their immorality, and it ought to be clear why they're that way, because they're godless people, but we're not godless people. And you talk about all of these things that are wrong with the Gentiles, but you understand, don't you, Paul, that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are Gentiles and then there are Jews, and we're very different from them. And Paul says, no, you're not. And herein, Paul is touching at something that I think lies at the very heart of the preaching of the gospel in the first century, lies at the very heart of the problem with what the Jewish people was and how the gospel was trying to address it. And I'd like to try, if I can this evening, to explain to you what the Jews thought about themselves for just a moment. You see, the Jews looked at themselves and said, we are the people of God. Plain and simple, that's what we are. That of all the people that were alive in Abraham's day, God chose our forefather Abraham. And God made promises to him, not to other people, but to Abraham, our forefather. And God said that he would bless his descendants and give them this land and give them the covenant and take care of them and fight their enemies and bring them to heaven in the end and make them his people. We are the people of God, is what they said. And with that came an assumption. That assumption was that because God has made us his people, that God is going to save us. That he's not going to do with us what he's done to the Gentiles. That the Gentiles going off on their own way, ignoring God, that they have wrath stored up for them, but as the people of God, we have a different fate awaiting us. That God has glory prepared for us. And Paul has the difficult task in Romans chapter 2 of debunking that attitude. And while we're on that subject, let me also explain, if I can, what the Jews did not believe about themselves. It has been very common. It has been the standard view, as a matter of fact, of Judaism up until the last 30 years or so, to think of Jews as just a bunch of legalistic religious heretics or quacks. People who thought that here we have the law of Moses, and if I do all the things that are written in this law of Moses, that God is going to save me. because I've done all the things that God said to do. As a matter of fact, the Pharisees said, we can do better than that. We can make laws on top of God's laws, and not only are we going to keep God's laws, but we're going to keep the laws on top of those. Those other laws keep us from ever getting close to violating God's laws. And so if we keep all of those laws, God's going to take us to heaven. And that has sometimes been described as legalism, or thinking in terms of merit, that the average Jew in the ancient world thought in terms of merit, that if I obey the law of God, then I'll go to heaven. But it has become very clear, as scholars have looked at Judaism very closely, that that's really not what the average Jew believed in the first century. What the Jews believed was what I just said to you. They said that we are the people of God. And the Jew would say that I do the works of the law of Moses in order to make sure that I am one of the people of God. That it is my obedience to the law and circumcision and not eating unclean food and all of those other things, observing the Sabbath day, that all of those things are what keeps me in the group of God's people. The Jews did not necessarily believe that their obedience to the works of the law was going to save them. What they believed that there was that their obedience to the works of the law made them the people of God, and that God had promised to save the people of God. That God had a group that he had already decided to save, and by obeying the law, they were maintaining their relationship with that group. Paul says, well, that's partially correct, but in a very important sense, it is incorrect. Paul says in verses 1 through 5, his indictment against the Jews. He says in verse 2, we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things, but do you suppose this, O man? When you pass judgment on those who practice such things, that is those Gentiles, and do the same things yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? And what Paul is trying to get them to see is that that was exactly what they believed. That, well, Paul, we might not be perfect. I'll grant you that. And the Jews would readily admit that they had not been perfect people and they were always trying to be better. But their answer was always, but we're the people of God, Paul. We're the people of God. And God has made a promise to us that he didn't make to them. And even if I'm not perfect, even if I'm not sinless, I'm still not going to be judged like those Gentiles. And Paul says, oh, yes, you are. Do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and tolerance and patience, not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance? But because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up for your wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. Paul is saying that the Jews are not only guilty of sin. Oh, it's worse than that. He's saying that they are just as guilty as the Gentiles. And not only is he saying that they are just as guilty as the Gentiles, he's saying that you have done the very same kinds of sins that the Gentiles have committed. Now, that's the kind of thing that to a Jew you'd have to say, now you're going to have to prove that to me. And that's what Paul is going to spend the rest of this chapter down to verse 20 talking about. But the first thing that Paul does is he establishes in verses 6 through 11 the impartiality of God. How is it that the Jews could be considered guilty like the Gentiles, Paul? Paul's answer is because God is impartial. You see, built into the Jewish way of thinking was a fundamental assumption that God really, at the end of the day, is partial. That he loves us more than he loves those Gentiles. That he's going to do for us what he won't do for them. That God's going to give us consideration that he won't give to them. And Paul says, if you know anything about God, you ought to know first and foremost that that's not the God of the Bible, that he is not partial. Paul says in verse 6, quoting from the Psalms, that God will render to each person according to his deeds. There will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Greek, and glory and honor and peace to everyone who does good, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Paul is trying to show that the Jews too are in need of salvation. That just because they were the people of God doesn't mean that they weren't sinners, that they weren't guilty, that they didn't have the same problem. But the Jews would say, now how can that be? Because God made us the people of God. He gave us this election. He made this choice of us. Surely you can see, Paul, that God is doing something for us that he didn't do for the Gentiles. Paul says, but that's the wrong way to think about that. Because the fact of the matter is that God is going to judge people according to what they did with what they were given. That's how God judges. He's going to judge people according to what they did with what they were given. Look at what Paul says in verse 12. All who have sinned without the law will perish without the law. And all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. You know, the Jews looked at the law and said, hey, we got the law. And the law kept us from being the sinners that the Gentiles were. Paul says, no, that's an incorrect assumption. The fact is that God intended you to keep that law, and he's going to judge you by that law. Well, what about these Gentiles over here that didn't have the law and ignored God and didn't do any of these things that we do? Paul says God's going to judge them according to what he told them. They knew about God. They knew that he was there. They knew that he was powerful. They knew that he was divine, and God's going to judge them on that basis. You get judged according to what you got, according to what you did with what you got. Yes, the fact is that God had revealed himself to the Jews in a way that he had not revealed himself to the Gentiles. But that doesn't make God partial. It means that he's going to judge the Jews according to the law that he gave them, and he's going to judge the Gentiles according to the knowledge that he gave them. And God will not be partial in any way. But people say, now wait a minute, Paul. You say that we're sinners, that we are just as guilty as the Gentiles. That can't be. Paul says, let me tell you, verses 17 and following, if you bear the name Jew, which is really the heart of the matter here, right? Hey, I'm a Jew. I've got this special privilege with God that I'm one of the people of God. If you bear that name and rely upon the law and boast in God and you know his will, and you approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, and you're confident that you are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, and a teacher of the immature, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and of the truth. And that's what the Jews said about themselves. Paul's going right down the line. But in quoting those boasts that the Jews made, Paul is establishing the very point about the Jews that he had made about the Gentiles. Remember that Paul had said in Romans 1 and verse 18 that they knew about God. Oh, they knew. And what about the Jews? Oh, they knew about God too. And they didn't just have that general knowledge that the Gentiles had. Oh, they had a very specific knowledge of God. And it was exactly as they said. They said that we've got the law. We've got a relationship with God. We can tell you what's right and wrong because God told it to us and not to you. And we can be a corrector of the foolish and a teacher of the immature because in the law we have the embodiment of knowledge. And so Paul says, okay, first of all, we have established that in terms of knowledge, you're just like the Gentiles. That you knew about God just like they did, perhaps you, or even more than that, you knew more than they knew about God. They even bragged about the fact that they had a more accurate knowledge of God, and it made them arrogant. But what did they do with that law? Verse 21, You who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one shall not steal, do you steal? The answer to that question is a painful yes, they do. Let's not get the impression that the Jews didn't steal, that the Jews didn't fornicate, that the Jews didn't lie. You have to read the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, Luke and John about that far into them to find out that those people lived those kinds of lives too. You who say that one should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Well, there was no getting around that. Adultery was just as much a problem among the Jews as it was any other people in the ancient world. But the Jews would say, well, Paul, maybe we're not perfect. Yes, there are Jews who commit adultery. We'll grant you that. There are Jews who lie and steal. Yes, we'll grant you that. But we're not idolaters. And remember, that's what Paul had said about the Gentiles, that not only did they know about God, but they suppressed the truth and they worshiped idols. Paul says, you don't think you're idolaters? You don't think you've done the same thing? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? The word that is translate rob temples there means in the Greek language to commit a sacrilege. And Paul's point is, are you going to stand there and tell me that you've never dishonored God? That you have never done anything to rob God of His glory? That you've not ascribed glory to somebody else or something else that should have been ascribed to God? You're telling me that that never happens among the Jews? Paul says, the fact is, verse 24, that the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written. And remember what we noted about the Gentiles, that when they worshipped idols, that that was a form of blasphemy, calling this idol, this human creation, calling it God is blasphemous. Paul says, don't you know that Isaiah talked about your generation? Don't you know that Isaiah talked about the Jews of the Messianic age? And he said that the name of God is blasphemed because of you. Yeah, you've blasphemed just like the Gentiles did. You've robbed God of His glory just like the Gentiles did. Oh, the procedure you used might have been a little different, but the end result was the same. You've committed the very same kinds of sin as the Gentiles. You've stolen, you've committed adultery, and you have blasphemed. And therefore, Paul says, the fact is that being Jewish was and is of no special advantage when it comes to salvation from judgment. And that's what Paul is pointing out there in Romans chapter 2, starting in verse 25. Now, circumcision is of value if you practice the law. But if you're not going to practice the law any better than those Gentiles do, then you're just like them. Your circumcision has become, as it were, uncircumcision. Your life is the life of a pagan. And Paul says, don't you see, it doesn't matter whether you've got the law or not. It's how you do with it. It's what you do with it. It's how you live according to it that determines whether you're saved or not, whether you're right or not. And that you didn't do, Paul says. And then he touches on something that he's going to come back to later in verse 28. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. And that was the problem with their thinking. Who did God make his promises to? Well, to Abraham and his descendants. Paul's going to say later on in the epistle, fine. But let's find out, if we can, from the Bible, what kind of person was Abraham? And who are the descendants that God was talking about? Now, the Jews had just assumed that, well, it's the ethnic. It is the bloodline of Abraham that God is talking about. What else could descendants be? We are descended from Abraham. We are ethnic Jews. Therefore, God has taken us to be His people. Paul says, you might be assuming a little too much there. Could it be that God was talking on a different level? Could it be that these Jews are not the outward Jews, but there's another way to define who is a Jew, another way to define who is a descendant of Abraham, a way that you didn't understand, a way that you missed. He who is a Jew is not one who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. He is a Jew who is one inwardly. What makes a person part of the people of God? The fact that you've got the blood of Abraham running through your veins? Or is it that you've got the mind of Abraham in you? It's not the outward stuff that makes you one of God's people, Paul says. It's those inward qualities. And that's where the Jews had missed the boat. Well, did you say, now, okay, Paul, let me get this straight. You're saying that God did all of this, that he spoke these promises to Abraham, that he took the Jews out of Egypt and brought them into the land of Canaan, that he multiplied them, made them great, made them wealthy in the time of Solomon. You're saying that all of that means that the Jews are nothing in the sight of God. That as far as God is concerned, the Jews are just exactly like those dirty, rotten pagans. That there is no advantage to being a Jew. Paul says, oh, there was an advantage to being a Jew. And that's what he starts off in chapter 3 with. What advantage has the Jew? What is the benefit of circumcision? Well, Paul says, first of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God. And that was the advantage, that they got to know more than other people. And what a blessing that was. We've been studying in the Sunday morning class about God revealing himself to the Israelites. And what a blessing that was supposed to be to them, to get to know their God in a way that nobody could have known their God in the ancient world. To actually hear his voice and to see his deeds of kindness and love written in their own history. Oh, you had a benefit. You got to know the God of the Old Testament better than all the nations around you. But this turns out to lay greater responsibility on the Jews as well, doesn't it? And there in verses 3 and 4, Paul says, what then, if some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? Paul's saying, now, you can't turn this into a criticism of God. You know, how could this be an advantage? You're saying, Paul, that God does all this, and now you're saying that the Jews are sinners. Aren't you saying, therefore, Paul, that God has done something that his people have miserably failed at? Doesn't that reflect poorly on God? And Paul says, no, it doesn't. Just because some did not believe, that doesn't mean that God is somehow to be criticized. It doesn't mean that God has forgotten his plan or has given up on working it or has failed to accomplish it. May it never be, let God be found true and every man a liar. But the Jews say, okay, Paul, but even if we are sinners and even if we're more sinners than we care to admit at times, doesn't that glorify God? Because isn't it true, Paul, that the more sinful we are, the more holy and righteous God appears to be? That when we are at our worst, it only shows that how great our God really is. And so, yes, even if we have sinned, it's not a problem, as it were, because it only glorifies God in the end. Paul says, I'm telling you this, that even if your sin makes God look good, that's no excuse for your sin. And it doesn't mean it's okay for you to be a sinner. Because the logical conclusion of that would be that I ought to be just as sinful as I possibly can be to give God the most glory. Why not say, verse 8, as we are slanderously reported and as some claim that we say, let us do good or evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just, which is Paul's way of saying that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Oh, you can't use your sin saying that it glorifies God, therefore that excuses me. And that even though I'm not perfect, I'm still the people of God. And as the people of God, we glorify God even with our sin. Paul says, no, you don't. Because of you, the name of God is blasphemed among the nations. And you're just as guilty as they are, and you're guilty in the same way that they are. And this is something that they needed to hear. You know, the Gentile Christians in Rome, they were saying, oh, there's no advantage to being a Jew. God has cast off his people. Paul says, no, there was an advantage. They're wrong about that. There was an advantage. And the Jews were saying, yeah, but we weren't like the Gentiles. Paul says, yes, you were. The fact is that all have sinned. And what Paul means by that is not so much that every individual has sinned, as true as that might be. Paul's point is that both Jews and Gentiles have sinned. And one cannot point at the other and say, we've turned out to be better than you. You're both sinners. You've both suppressed the truth that you had. You both refused to obey what you knew. You both blasphemed God in the process. You're both sinners. And Paul concludes, therefore, in verses 9 through 18 with this long list of scriptural quotations. And he's taken phrases from all over the Bible that talk about sinners. Verse 10, there is none righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There's no one who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they've become useless. There's no one who does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And Paul says, do you know who God was talking about when he said all of those things? That whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. God was talking about the Jews in every one of those passages. Oh, the Jews looked at those passages and said, oh, that's God talking about those dirty, rotten pagans. Paul says, no, he wasn't. Your own Bible says that you're sinners. But the Jews would say, ah, Paul, there's one thing you haven't considered that makes you wrong. Because we had the law of Moses. And even if we didn't keep it, even if we didn't follow God's commands, we had the sacrifices. God said that if we sinned, we could offer a sacrifice, that he would that would atone for our sins, and he did not give that privilege to the Gentiles. And so we had atonement and they didn't. And Paul says, but you've misunderstood the law. Verse 20, because by the works of the law no flesh will be justified in his sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Not the solution to sin, the knowledge of sin. And this thing that the Jews looked at and said, oh, we're right with God because we have these sacrifices. Paul says they weren't making forgiveness. The law wasn't designed to do that. No flesh gets justified through the law of Moses. All of those things were designed to point out and to remind you of just what a sinner you were, and you misunderstood those things, Paul says. The conclusion is, therefore, that all have sinned. And just briefly, I want to suggest to you that you and I are no different. That Paul could have written this yesterday, and it would be just as true of us as it was of them. That all have sinned, Jews and Gentiles. There is none righteous, not even one. God forbid the day that any one of us should come to the conclusion that these people had come to, that the problem of sin is not my problem, that that's something somebody else needs to worry about, that other people are sinners but not me. You're never going to come to appreciate this thing called the gospel until you first learn to say that I am a sinner. And when you can say those words, then you can begin to appreciate the story of Jesus. If you're here this evening and you have come to that conclusion in your life that I am a sinner and I need to be forgiven of my sins this very night, we stand ready to help you do that. If you're not a child of God, we can help you to obey the gospel. We have a baptistry and garments here that you can change into, and you can be baptized into Christ tonight. If you're already a child of God and you've not lived as you should, and you've fallen back into those ways that were yours before your life in Christ began, and you need to repent of some sin, we stand ready to help you and encourage you and pray with you if we can, that you might be right with God. If you need His forgiveness, He now offers it. Won't you come as we stand and sing this song together?